Welcome. This is Christopher Holmes, and this is a two-hour zero-point radio show through BBS Radio, and it's August 7th, 2010. Zero-point is a term taken from the writings of mystic Madame Blavatsky from her book The Secret Doctrine, and the concept is that living beings have a zero-point center, which is like or is the first point of differentiation of a cosmos. It's like living beings grow from a zero-point source, or what appears to us to be a point source. And so I also describe Blavatsky's work in my writings and work under the title or logo of Zero Point Institute for Mystical and Spiritual Science. And that's the aim through the Zero Point Show, is to explore mystical and spiritual psychologies and science and metaphysics and creation studies, and also to look at contemporary issues. I'm coming to you from just south of Ottawa, Ontario, and my co-host is James Moffat from Toronto, Ontario. Hi, Jim. How are you?
Good. How are you, Chris?
Okay, good. I didn't know if you had any thing you wanted to pick up from any ideas for today's show. I know I was going to go into a little bit of some current reading that I'm doing of David Icke's and try to relate it to Gurdjieff a bit, and then I thought we'd try to go back to The Secret Doctrine and continue discussing some of that material.
Yeah, I thought we'd perhaps you were going to pick up on the presentation quite a while ago on God, Science, and The Secret Doctrine, and we talked about it last program, and yeah, I thought we might continue along those lines.
Yeah, we had a good show last week. I wish I could remember what.
Yeah, well, it was kind of far-reaching. We covered a lot of material, and a lot of it specifically related to issues of consciousness derived from esotericism and from Madame Blavatsky and the Gurdjieff teaching in particular. I know it's a really good program. I can't exactly remember what precisely we talked about. We talked about a lot of different things. We talked a lot about, I do know that we, at the beginning of the program, I made a brief presentation about the Heart Doctrine, your book, and did a bit of just a quick oral review of that. And then from that, I think we picked up on a whole variety of issues related to the Heart Doctrine versus the Head Doctrine in modern psychology, and the differences between modern scientific ideas about consciousness and ancient esoteric mystical ideas on the nature of consciousness. So it was, it was a good program. And I think, if I'm not mistaken, I think we were sort of leading to, we didn't really get into zero points that much, I don't think, in the last session. I think we touched on that, but we didn't. I think what you were going to talk about, or what you suggested you might talk about, was that you wanted to pick up a little bit more on sort of the higher dimensional physics and metaphysics of the, that you elaborate in your book on God, Science, and the Secret Doctrine.
Yeah, I had wanted to try to explain some of the holographic physics of it.
It's
complex to explain it, and it's hard to do without visuals in a way. But I would like to try to come back to that today, so we will come back to that. We also talked about the idea of, in the mystical view, how the study of consciousness has to include a cosmology. You had brought that up, and we discussed that widely. And I wanted to bring up some material today, which I've just recently read, and I'm still trying to assimilate it. It's from a book by David Icke, his newest book, which is called Human, Get Off Your Knees, The Lion Sleeps No More. And it's his... it's another one of his, like, is there some caller in or someone there on the background?
I didn't hear anything. But
oh, you didn't hear anything?
No.
Oh, okay. I heard a couple of disturbances. Anyway, so that's the name of his book, and it's another one of Ike's, you know, almost 700 pages of research, you know, going from ancient history and language study and modern politics and all the things being done in the world, from chemtrails to, you know, vaccinations. It's one of his, you know, this is the third book I've read of Ike this year. I read The Biggest Secret and David Icke's Guide to the Global Conspiracy. All very interesting books, and he draws from such a range of issues and topics and histories. Quite fascinating books. Anyway, I want to explain a little bit. The basic thesis that Ike is known for, and I think it's most unique to his work, and I'm not sure anybody else really claims this or elaborates it, I'm not really sure. But Ike's basic thesis is that all modern human history there's been these bloodline families that all go back to a reptilian race that interbreeded with human beings on the earth in early history, and that religions all and mythologies around the world depict these types of reptilian beings who kind of came down, and in the Bible they took themselves wives. Like, they looked upon the women and took themselves wives and interbred with humankind. So he's trying to draw all the enigmas and mysteries of human ancestry and such together, and mythology and such. And his basic argument is that there's an actual reptilian race who manipulate humanity from the moon, and also have underground bases on Earth and Mars. And this is really quite fascinating. And he has whole sections on the moon. And I'm just trying to read through it, and I'm still in the middle of the book. But he claims that the moon is actually hollowed out, and apparently there's evidence, as he maintains, that it doesn't have as high a density as it should really have. And he actually sees the moon as being a spaceship that was actually planted in orbit in the way that it was. And, of course, in modern science, and there's a lot of mysteries about the origin of the moon and a lot of different theories, and it certainly isn't settled from a scientific point of view, the origin of the moon. And certain things about the moon, the way in which it's in, I'm not sure what the word is, in, not entrapped, but it's hooked into a certain synchronized motion with respect to the Earth, that it always shows the same face to the Earth. So we never see the dark side of the moon. We don't see the dark side of the moon because it's dark. But the way, and the Earth, so it keeps the same face towards the Earth, and it also, the moon subtends half a degree of arc in the sky, and that's exactly the same amount as the sun subtends. So it's half a degree of arc. That's why you can have a lunar eclipse with the sun the moon actually just fits over the sun and can almost obscure the whole sun, and you just see the sun's corona behind the moon. So that's a lunar eclipse. But anyway, so David Icke is claiming that it's a reptilian base on the moon, and that they have underground bases, and this is tied into underground bases on planet Earth, and that these people have through history. They've maintained their bloodlines through the elite families, and that the people from these families, because of their blood types and genetics, are more able to be vehicles for these reptilian entities, which he sees as fourth dimensional. And that, yeah, and he maintains that they can act through people or possess people in a certain way. So that's why if you go on YouTube, you see certain little videos of people who are supposed to be shape-shifting, and you see different features in the eyes or in the mouth, mainly from what I've seen, where people are supposed to be shape-shifting. But anyway, so Ike is maintaining, and he maintains that these beings actually carry on kind of satanic ceremonies around the world, sacrificing children and engaging in other black magic practices and drinking the blood. And he sees this reptilian race is actually feeding off humankind. And I'll just go through some of his books and read a few quotes, and then I want to tie it all back into things Gurdjieff says about the moon, and because some of what David Icke says has fascinating relationships to things that Gurdjieff explains. Are you with me there, Jim?
Okay.
You ready for some reptilians today?
I guess I have one question. How does he know that these bases exist on the moon? How would you possibly know that?
Photographs, witness testimonies. I mean, I'd have to go through the book and draw out what he presents as evidences. Certainly it's not any kind of airtight case, but he's
well,
claiming this. And
Okay. I think I know where you're going with this a little bit, but okay, yeah.
It's fascinating, actually, and I'll just read parts of it. Like, Ike is saying that these beings through the moon control and have, in a way, hypnotized the mind of humankind and establish what he calls their moon matrix. The moon, he says, rules the mind and both thoughts and feelings. I'm just going to read a few quotes a little bit. The moon's influence is happening in the metaphysical universe, the information blueprint from which everything in the holographic realm of physical experience is made manifest. I've lost just a couple of these quotes. What I said earlier about the moon being an interdimensional, interdensity portal that allows entities and energies to be transferred from other densities into this one. It is a means by which the fourth density reptilians lock humankind into their hive mind. And then the next sentence is, Sagan repeated in the second dream that he had been killed for what he knew. Have you ever heard about these two dreams that Carl Sagan is reported to have had, Jim, concerning aliens and such?
No.
Yeah, I'm going to try to dig them out here. Over the next while, I'll see if I can draw them out. I can't remember exactly what they were, but he had dreams about this, apparently. So he says that reptilians have hacked into the system. It's a sort of cosmic game. The universe was created as an energetic construct based on the receiving and transmitting of information. Okay, I'm going to just move along a little bit and try to find a couple more. He says how when people awaken and start to escape the perceptual confines of mind, they are disconnecting from the moon matrix and reconnecting with the photons from the sun. through which we can, in turn, reconnect with the all that is. See, I contrast what he calls the mind, which is like our acquired mind and personality or persona, with what he calls the infinite consciousness, which is what he says we are essentially, and that this infinite consciousness within us has been hidden from us as human beings. So we've lost this birthright, and then we have this whole mind kind of created as a realm of illusion and controlled by the moon. And this is all very interesting. In Gurdjieff, we have very similar concepts. Like, Gurdjieff has what he calls the ray of creation, and which is seven levels to the ray of creation, and it begins with all worlds, and then our galaxy, and then within our galaxy is our solar system, and then the planets, and then the Earth, and then the Moon, and then the absolute nothing below the Moon. So Gurdjieff has this ray of creation with seven levels in it. And in that level, like, it's said to correspond as a macrocosm, it's said to correspond to the microcosm of a human being. So, for instance, a human being is said to have parts. Like, we have the physical body, which a physical body is a product of the earth. And when we die, the physical body goes back and feeds the earth, like the elements in the physical body. And Gurdjieff says when any organic life form dies, a certain energy he calls the soul energy, he says, feed the moon. So certain energies pass to the moon. And Gurdjieff says that we have a level in us, in our essence, that responds to the levels of the planets and of the sun. And then Gurdjieff says in our highest possible being body, that we're actually of the starry worlds. So Gurdjieff says that there, the levels of the galaxy and the solar system and the sun and the planets and the earth and the moon, there's something in the human being that corresponds to each of these levels of the solar system or of existence. So Gurdjieff would say, for instance, when we die, we can pass into the sun. If we've attained what he calls our mental body, then he says we can live within the sun. And Gurdjieff says that we can become immortal within the limits of the solar system if we attain our spiritual body. Otherwise, Gurdjieff describes that the soul can pass to the moon. And he says the soul still live on consciously in the moon, but under very prison-like, confining, restricted circumstances. On the moon, Gurdjieff in the ray of creation, each level in the ray of creation has more fundamental laws, so if you live under the influence of the moon, Gurdjieff would say you're living under 96 laws. Whereas if you're on a level above that, if you're more a practical person contained by practical and earthly things, on the earth there are said to be 48 laws. The level of the planets is 24 laws, and the level of the sun is 12 laws. So each of these levels, it's like each level is more subtle than the level below it. So to be under the control of the moon, like that would Gurdjieff would say, false personality is related to the moon. Negative emotions, anger. Here's some quotations from Gurdjieff's writing on the moon, or from Uspensky. Uspensky says, all our mechanicalness depends on the moon. We are like marionettes moved by wires, but we can be more free of the moon or less free. When we understand this, we will understand the way to become more free is by not identifying, not considering, struggling with negative emotions, and so on. At the present, we cannot move a step without the energy of the moon. All sleeping people are under the influence of the moon, but if a man develops, he can gradually cut some of the wires that are undesirable and can open himself to higher influences. In this way, he can become free from the moon. So there, the idea then in Gurdjieff is a certain negative emotions in human beings and states of identification and such, all these lower negative emotional energies in a way feed the moon and are controlled by the moon. But he also says much of our action and crowd behavior and rituals and automatic behavior, he sees as all controlled by the moon. So the moon, is in a way, represents a level of our psyche. So then it's very interesting reading David Icke, who then he has the whole same model of how humankind is controlled by the moon, but he actually has reptilian beings out there living there in the hollowed out moon. It's fascinating, and he claims that through their history on the planet moon that they've done genetic engineering with human beings on planet Earth, in a way kind of breeding with us and doing genetic experimentations to develop different species. So he has seen these moon creatures as involved in genetic manipulation and human evolution. And that's also very interesting in how it relates to things Madame Blavatsky says in The Secret Doctrine. Because Madame Blavatsky says that what she calls the lunar pritis, or intelligences, she says, form the astral body. And then Blavatsky says the astral body is a template for the physical body. So Blavatsky, in a way, is saying that there are these intelligences from the moon who help form the physical body. But then Blavatsky says, but there are higher solar pritis, which are the intelligences of the sun, the spiritual sun, and that they form the inner man or inner human being. So it's interesting, Jim, how some of David Icke's ideas about these reptilians helping to kind of form humankind genetically and involved in forming the material body, interesting how that finds such a parallel in what Blavatsky says also. And even in the volume 2 of The Secret Doctrine, Blavatsky describes periods where these entities were creating different beings, like it was like they were doing genetic mutations. And she described some of them that they created were like horrible and soulless things, and they died out and were brutal and so on. She described such periods of earlier experimentation. That's in volume 2 of The Secret Doctrine. So I've been reading David Icke, and I'm going to continue on, and in 2 weeks' time I'll try to have a bit better grasp of how he actually sees these reptilians controlling humankind through the moon matrix. But it's fascinating material. Any thoughts, Jim?
I guess I come back to the questions like, how would you know this? But it is interesting that when you were saying this, one thing that when Gurdjieff discusses the ray of creation, and he talks about how everything descends through these seven levels, realms of differing materiality and consciousness, and which are under various classes of laws, so that you have everything kind of descends from the absolute through these different worlds to the earth. And then the last level is the moon. And at one point he talks about that the moon is the outer darkness that is spoken of in the Bible, and that that really, in terms of the octave, the octave begins in the absolute, descends through all these levels, but returns to zero at the moon. So in a way, it's kind of like, you know, the idea that the moon is something, I'm not even sure how to articulate this, is the moon is something that is nothing within the ray of creation is there in Gurdjieff's teaching. I mean, there's a lot of different things said about the moon, like you say. I mean, he keeps talking all the time about how everything mechanical on Earth is caused by the moon's influences. If somebody, you know, fights a war, it's because the moon does it. Somebody kills somebody, it's the moon does it, you know. And
yeah.
So these ideas do exist within Gurdjieff's teaching, and it's hard to... It's hard to kind of grasp what he's talking about because on some levels, I mean, you know, it's hard to tell when he's speaking literally and when he's speaking metaphorically and what the dynamics are that underlie all of this. But it's interesting because today I was just rereading, there's a passage that I was looking for in Search of the Miraculous by Uspensky about Gurdjieff, and he's talking about personality and essence in human beings, and personality is everything that we acquire through our exposure to life, through our education, our socialization, and our relationship with our families and other children, and then adults that teach us and everything. Everything that's conditioned and acquired, and essence is what we are born with, what we are in terms of our disposition and our proclivities and our physical and emotional capabilities and strengths and weaknesses. And he says that, you know, that essence grows until about the age of six, but personality grows over essence like a crust, and that like a little child is in essence, like lives in his essence. He is what he is. But then as he gets exposed to the world, he starts to get encrusted with this personality, all these sources of information and conditioning and education that form this personality, which grows over essence. And Gurdjieff says, for that reason, many people, even accomplished people, have the essence of a six-year-old, and because it just doesn't grow, it doesn't interact with life, because it's, everything we do in life is through personality. And at one point, and this is what I was trying to find in the book, because I couldn't remember if it was in that book or if it was in another book, but he speaks about personality in essence, and he says in certain esoteric schools, it's possible through the use of hypnosis or certain narcotics to separate personality and essence in people. And you can actually see that people are very different in their personalities and their essences. And then later in the book, Uspensky recounts this experience where Gurdjieff had said that he was going to show his pupils various things through experiments, but he had never actually done any of these experiments. So he did this experiment with two of the pupils in his group, and one was an older, more accomplished guy who was very well educated and had lots of firm opinions about all sorts of things and was very respectable, and the other was person was a younger guy who was kind of a jokester and a bit of a buffoon and never really seemed to take things seriously and didn't seem to grasp, but he was all over the place when he'd speak. He didn't seem to grasp the ideas of what was being taught, and he never really made sensible connections, and people couldn't follow him. So Uspensky says, I can't tell you what Gurdjieff did, but it seems from everything I've read that he hypnotized these two people. And all of a sudden, the guy that was the older, more accomplished guy was asked various questions by other pupils in the group, and he was essentially speechless. He didn't have anything to say. He had no opinions. He had no ideas about anything. He had been talking about before about the this was the First World War, about the effects of the war on his family and how it was driving a gap between the members of the family, and he was incredibly concerned about this and everything. And once he was hypnotized, they asked him about that, and he said, oh, I have no opinion about that at all. I don't know what you're talking about. And at one point, he was asked, what do you really want? And he said, I think I'd like some raspberry jam. And he was revealed in his essence to really not be anything at all. Like, he was just this very simple creature who wanted some raspberry jam. On the other hand, the young guy had been observing all this and began to speak, and Uspensky says his voice was different from what it normally was, and he provided this very articulate and insightful analysis of what was happening, and spoke in a completely from a completely different place in himself than something that they'd never seen. So he Gurdjieff said, "This is, you know, this is personality in essence. This is, all of us are like this. That many people who have very rich personalities have very, very underdeveloped essences." The line that got me though was at the end of all the story. Was at the end, somebody said, "Is this some type of black magic?" And Gurdjieff said, "No. In fact," he said, "it's much worse, and you will see that there is much worse," which is like really kind of disturbing when you think about it, because he's saying, like, not only do we not recognize how artificial our personalities and our lack of essence is, but also that there's something worse than that. Like, I'm trying to think, like, geez, what could be worse than that? Like, I mean, that's about as bad as it gets. And so it's kind of like, you know, like the idea that we could all be completely deluded about everything is not in some way, I mean, in essence, that's what Gurdjieff is teaching, is that we're all asleep and that everything that happens in the world is done by sleeping people, and the only important thing is to wake up. And to a certain extent, you can, you know, you and I have studied this for 35 years, and oh yeah, we understand that, but we understand it in our own way. I mean, there's obviously much greater depth to it than even what we understand and what we've observed. And so I guess that's in relationship to what you're saying. There are probably all sorts of deep, dark, dirty things that are going on that we don't have the first clue about. So, you know. Who knows?
Yeah, it's interesting, and it's interesting how Ike's kind of viewpoint, in a way, it's like a concretization of things that Gurdjieff says, but mm-hmm. Gurdjieff doesn't say there are entities on the moon who are reptilians or anything like that. Even though in Beelzebub's Tales to His Grandson, he actually says that there are beings on the moon that have tunneled it all out. So that's interesting also, he says. But Gurdjieff doesn't see the moon as being a spaceship planted in orbit. What he sees the moon, he says, in Beelzebub's Tales, he says a comet hit the Earth and broke off the moon and the secondary moon, which he says we don't know about or is not known in modern astronomy. So Gurdjieff saw this catastrophe happening on the Earth. And in Gurdjieff's Beelzebub's Tales, he explains that this was the cause of, like, cataclysmic events on the planet Earth, and then even then there were subsequent cataclysms as the moon adjusted into its orbit, and when it kind of settled into orbit, there was a secondary perturbation that kind of disrupted life on Earth. And so Gurdjieff had that kind of view of the of the moon being produced by this type of cosmic catastrophe. So it's very different than what Ike is saying. He's actually saying that the moon is a spacecraft planted in orbit by these reptilians, and then they kind of carry out these genetic experimentation and modifications with human beings on the planet, and that we've kind of been the slave of this race through history, and they've affected this control through control of the mind and creating this world of illusion and delusion. And it's very interesting, some of his descriptions of it. See, he actually sees these reptilians are actually in these subtle dimensions, so they're not, they are made physical through a human being. it's all very interesting, all very puzzling to me. In ways, at times, Gurdjieff does talk about the moon. It's like a soul can pass to the moon. And he describes, as you were saying, Jim, that's a place where there's a wailing and gnashing of teeth. And he says that even souls who go to the moon are still can still evolve, but it takes immense period of time because they go into a lower dimensional world, and it's almost like they're slaves of the moon, and they're kind of kept in servitude in these kind of world of the mind on the moon. It's interesting. I've heard two other people who talk about the moon feeding carnivorously off human beings. And one of those is Adi Da. You know, Da Lavananda, or Adi Da, the teacher. He talks about the moon feeding carnivorously. He uses that term, off human beings. Yeah. And the other is the visionary artist Alex Gray, who had visions of that on LSD. He described that on Coast to Coast AM with George Norrie. And that was fascinating. He kind of saw the moon as this kind of alien dimension.
Wow.
Yeah, so it's all very, very interesting. And it's hard to see. It's like these levels of the larger cosmos. In a mystical perspective, these are related to levels of ourselves. And, And so some people seem to have the vision that the moon, that when people, souls pass to the moon upon death and they live in servility there, it's like they work there and they're kind of physical and mental slaves in the interior of the moon, and this is all quite peculiar. So anyway, I'm enjoying David Icke's book, and I'll try to answer your questions more. He has a complex understanding of it. It's not simply that you would expect to go to the moon and see physical reptilians moving around there. He has an interesting of the moon view of the moon, of how in a way it's a portal, a base for entities that really come from a level beyond the moon, and they act through the moon and its influences. It's all very interesting, and it's interesting its relationship to things said by Blavatsky and how she sees certain beings associated with the moon as doing experimentation and genetic manipulations on Earth. Like, that's even in Blavatsky in Volume 2 of The Secret Doctrine. Because I remember she says at points that they create these kind of horrible hybrids that are kind of vicious and die out and such like that. That human evolution wasn't just a singular evolving line, but there were like dead ends in earlier species that didn't work out. I mean, we see that even from the dinosaurs. You know, the dinosaurs were made extinct. But anyway, it's David Icke's book. It's a fascinating book, and I'll work through it, and in 2 weeks' time, try to come back to this. And I found he had such an interesting idea of how information is encoded in light, and how the moon matrix has interfered with the information encoded in the sunlight from the sun. And this is also interesting from Gurdjieff's perspective, because the sun is like a higher world, so it has this kind of purity of information. And the moon matrix, he says, alters this light of the sun.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, there's a very interesting quotes on that, which I'll try to come back next time.
I can't really explain this because I don't really understand it, but I've just been reading Science, Meaning, and Evolution by Bazrav Nicolescu, which is on the cosmology of Jacob Bohm. Mm-hmm. And in Bohm's work, like, he talks about that the laws of 3 and 7 is very similar to Gurdjieff,
Well.
And Nicolescu, who knows Gurdjieff, says it's, you know, it's interesting that nobody's tried to examine and provide a, you know, detailed analysis of the parallels in their cosmology. But just the other night I was reading, and this is why I hesitate, because I can't, he talks about like the first triad and then the octave, which fulfills the triad in terms of creation. So very similar to the idea of the ray of creation. And he talks about Lucifer, and like Lucifer's sin is that Lucifer becomes a force of resistance, which turns the first triad back and doesn't allow it to progress to fulfill the octave. I'm sort of confabulating this a little bit, but that's the idea of Lucifer. Lucifer is this resistant force which turns things upside down and doesn't allow the light to progress and inform the lower levels. It's very, very.
Oh, yeah. That's very similar to what he's saying about the moon matrix.
Coming from such different sources, that the same idea about this, you know, something blocking the light in a sense, you know. This is a very interesting book, Chris. You'd really, really like this. It certainly fits in. It's consistent with everything in your work, and would just add another element to it. It's interesting because he's about half the book is his analysis, and then the last half is a selection of material from Bohm's writings, but I think mainly from the Aurora. But as Nick, there isn't anything in this that is inconsistent with what you're arguing, and it's incredibly similar to, you know, other sources from other teachings, you know, and this is somebody who experienced this directly and who wasn't a product of a school but just had these illuminated experiences and everything. Very, very interesting material.
Yeah, really. I we'll try to look for something. It's so hard to find the material on Jacob Bohm.
It's very, very difficult. I looked for quite a while and I found this book, and I actually have Aurora, which is, it's hard to get any of his material.
Oh.
I talked to a guy who was in a group and they were studying some of his work, and he says really, really hard to find. He owned a used bookstore, and he said I can't find it, you know. So I found a couple things on the internet, you know. It's like, that's one thing about finding books and esoteric materials, that the internet is such a great tool, eh? Because I mean,
yeah, it's amazing.
If you're stuck in one location, and you know, there's only so many books that sort of come through, but you can find these very interesting materials, and I kept thinking of you when I was reading this, because I thought, gee, this is so consistent with, you know, it just fits in with the other materials, and as I say, Bohm's so interesting because he wasn't somebody who was in any way associated with any formal teaching or school, and he didn't have much formal education, and yet he had these, you know, he had these amazing experiences where he experienced these things directly. And isn't it interesting that, you know, that again, somebody with no preconceived notions of any of these things comes up with the exact same descriptions, you know, like I say, he's talked about the law of three and the law of seven, essentially.
Yeah, I mean, that's what's so amazing about those principles is how widely you find them.
And everything, yeah.
Yeah, and all these different mystical teachings, and how in modern times, like, there's been no, I've never even heard them mentioned in the mainstream of modern science. Like, I've never heard anyone in the mainstream even mention the idea of considering that there might be basic principles in the laws of three and seven.
And that's why when people, you know, a consistent thing that comes up in the critics of atheists and skeptical, rationalist, skeptical commentators who deny that, you know, that religion has anything to teach us, and that science is sort of overturned and overthrown everything. I mean, they don't seem to be aware at all. And like within every major religious tradition, there's this idea of the law of three. It's in the Holy Trinity. It's in the three gunas. It's in the the three hidden splendors in Kabbalah. I mean, it recurs in all sorts of teachings and again and again. And it's such a basic principle. And when I've actually just been writing a little bit about this, so it's kind of fresh in my mind about, you know, I mean, when I first read in Search of the Miraculous, I was reading about Gurdjieff and the idea of the Law of Three and Seven. I thought, well, I didn't see how this is ever going to be something that I could incorporate into my own life, or I thought it was interesting, but it didn't mean anything to me in a sense. You know, I thought, okay, the psychological ideas have validity, and so based on that, I'm certainly willing to suspend my judgment and to realize that I really don't know what this means. I think it was mainly the first thing when I really started to understand how valuable the Law of Three was in your formulation, when you started to critique modern psychological theories and to show how within modern psychological theories you have these recurring dualities, and that everybody wants to divide the world into two parts, and that this is a self element in psychological theorizing. And at the time, in the mid-70s, we were in the throes of split-brain fever, where the studies in hemispheric lateralization, the left brain and the right brain, were very, very popular and were all the rage, and you had all sorts of books written about these ideas, and everything in a human being was supposed to be in one hemisphere, and its opposite, or its putative opposite, was supposed to be in the other hemisphere. And as you pointed out, like, Robert Ornstein, who was a theorist who talked about the two modes of consciousness, had intellect and in one hemisphere, the left hemisphere, and sensation in the other hemisphere. But he also had passion and intuition as being opposites of intellect. So the sensation equal passion equals intellect. I mean, it's absurd. The whole thing was so overblown. I mean, there are differences in the two hemispheres in the brain. That's clearly a fact. But this is a self element in psychology. It reflects and expresses our verbal analytic thinking, and it's not real, because as Gurdjieff says, there's always a third force in things. It's either the medium in which something exists, or it's a hidden variable, a hidden property which people in the normal waking state don't see. And on that level, on a psychological level, I realized what a valuable perspective this is on challenging all sorts of assumptions, which nobody ever seems to realize. Like, that nobody ever seems to understand that this, you know, this dualistic thinking pervades modern thought, and that it's not real, it's not accurate. I mean, there are all sorts of dualities in life, and our thinking reflects that. But you have to go beyond the dualities to understand things comprehensively. Like, the mistake is in taking the dualities as providing a coherent and comprehensive whole. But the whole is always something more. It always includes this third element. And that's a basic way in which I would say that a fundamental idea in religious, various religions, which recurs in all these religions, is a scientifically testable and applicable idea. It certainly provides a alternative to the theoretical positions that sort of pervade modern thinking and psychology and various aspects of science. And like, for instance, within physics, you know, it used to be it was matter and energy, but now it's matter, energy, and intelligence. Like, they, you know, physics has come to this point where they've recognized that there's this third force, or that there's the Trinity is actually the more comprehensive and complete representation of things.
Yeah, they even call it third force science.
Third force
which
science
recognizes that there's information which is somehow latent within space itself, within the medium.
Yeah.
And the information is like third force that gives direction.
Precisely what Gurdjieff was saying, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
100 years ago, you know, or 90 years ago is exactly what he was saying. And same thing with the law of the octave, where you have these discontinuous steps. You know, Bazrab Nicolescu wrote a very interesting paper about that. He's a physicist, and he said, you know, that Gurdjieff alluded to the fact that there were certain developments in science at that time, which was the development of the idea of the quanta and that reality was discontinuous. That was sort of happening just as he was saying this thing. But I mean, it's recognized within the principles of the law of seven. Like the law of seven just isn't like the idea that there are seven things. It's that the things exist in octave structures, and that there's a whole kind of complex explanation of what an octave structure is, and that it's a discontinuous process which is applicable, Gurdjieff says, to everything in life and in the universe. Like everything on every level of every realm is made up of either descending or ascending or deviating octaves. So you know, it's a fundamental cosmic law, and it's a very profound idea. But as you say, nobody ever examines these things or talks about them. Even if you're going to use them as a heuristic to question things, it's a very useful tool to just look at things and say, oh, there's another way of looking at this. As I say, like when you did that with in challenging that, like this whole idea of the two modes of consciousness, I thought that was quite brilliant, you know, and really that's the first thing where I really understood, oh, this definitely has applicability in life. I just couldn't have imagined that at the beginning when I first read about the law of three and the law of seven.
Yeah, you could see how much dualistic thinking dominated particularly the soft sciences. Like psychology. Because whenever you find out, like you can say, verbal analytic, well, then what's the opposite of verbal analytic? Well, nonverbal, form-based, synthetic.
Yeah.
Or you can say time-bound versus timelessness. The conscious, the unconscious, left brain, right brain.
Thinking and divergent thinking.
Yeah, and they had hundreds, and every...
Oh, there's all sorts of them, you know, like it's...
Yeah.
The whole area is dominated by such dualistic thinking.
Yeah, everyone came up with their own favorite duality, and became known for all these different dualities, you know?
Yeah, and there again, too, like within... applying Gurdjieff's teaching is that, you know, when he says that, well, in modern psychology, like, you know, psychology is defined in introductory textbooks as being the study of the behavior in the mind, or alternatively, it's, you know, they talk about the mind and the body. And like, from a Gurdjieff perspective, it's like his model is that we are three and seven brain beings. Like he breaks it down in different ways, but in our normal waking state of consciousness, we are essentially three brain beings who have an intellectual, emotional, and a physical moving, what he calls a moving instinctual centers of intelligence, which interact. And then he says, but a complete human being, a finished human being who's developed properly, has seven centers of intelligence, including two higher centers of intelligence. Well, that's a much more complex model, and especially when you apply the idea of the centers to a human being, it takes the entire human being in. Like the mind body thing is really interesting because it's become, it's not necessarily that it should have developed this way, but it's become sort of like the template is sort of that the mind controls the body. Like almost everything in psychology, you would think that really, you know, your body's just there to eat and, you know, feed itself and have sex and get around town, basically, you know, and everything's controlled by the mind and in the head and the brain. But, you know, the nature of our being, the parts of our being are so much more complex than that, and involve so many different systems, like the subcortical systems and the gastric and the solar plexus and the autonomic nervous system. I mean, it's just like, and you know, the different organs and neural hormones that circulate through the vascular system. I mean, there's all these different systems within a human being, and they're not all controlled by the brain. Like, that's completely ridiculous, you know. Obviously, the brain interacts with everything that's going on in the body, but the blood is the one thing that is distributed throughout the body. So, in a way, like, you know, the most primary the most primary system in a human being, it isn't really the brain. The brain is the primary organ, people think, but it's actually the heart and the circulation of blood in the vascular system are actually more fundamental. If you don't have a heart, you don't have a vascular system, you don't have much. You don't have much in the way of life or consciousness, you know.
Yeah, in the physical body. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting. That's one of the criticisms I have of David Icke's book, is how much he gets into this left brain, right brain
I remember you saying
duality.
That yeah.
And he kind of saying, you know, humankind has to awaken, and what that is awakening the right brain. It's opposed to left brain. And I think the left brain, right brain distinction for Gurdjieff, he talks about what he calls mentation by thought and mentation by form. And I think that dichotomy kind of applies to left and right brain.
Yeah.
But like so many people, it's interesting in Icke's book, at times he talks about the heart, and he talks about the heart chakra as being the center of our being. And then he kind of slips into this left brain, right brain. Because what I see as important is the false consciousness system is in the mind, in the head, left brain or right brain.
Right.
It doesn't. There are differences between the hemispheres, but the major shift that needs to be is the dissolution of the false mind into the lotus of the heart. So, and that's kind of from a mystical point of view. We've this infinite consciousness that David Icke talks about. It's not right brain consciousness, it's the deeper consciousness of the heart, which is then ties into kind of the holographic physics of what a human being really is. That there's a whole higher dimensional physics to the human heart, or the zero point center connected to the heart. So that, it's interesting, I can, like, when Icke is writing about historic evidences and things like that, like I'm not studied enough to criticize him in those areas, but I can see when he comes to psychology and discussing consciousness, I can see the limitations in his understanding. I can see how he's close to it, because he talks about this distinction between the mind versus the infinite consciousness, and that's kind of between the head and the heart. And at times he talks about the heart, but then he, as I say, he slips into this left brain, right brain. And it's like people think, you know, left brain is sequential. So then people think, well, if you're in your right brain, there is no time. It's timeless. But that's silly. Like, even if you're in your right brain, things are still sequential.
Yeah.
You know, even in the form realm, they're sequential. It's like, you see the dualistic thinking. It's so hard because... it's a dualistic thinking. Anyway, I'll come back to that. I'm going to continue on and get through Icke's book and come back to talk more about the moon and what he says about the reptilians. It was interesting this time in being exposed to Icke's work. What was interesting to me is I had a more abstract idea of what he was saying these entities are. That they're not simply physical reptilian beings, but they're actually entities from within slightly different subtle dimensions. He calls it the fourth dimension. But and then they manifest into the physical dimension. So he has a much more complex model of what these reptilians are than simply seeing them as an alien species. Besides the fact of which, he now sees them as having interbred with human beings through the centuries. So, you know, they also kind of form part of the genetic inheritance of humankind in this view. So anyway, I'll try to get through that over the next couple of weeks, and we can come back and talk more about this. He also ties it into what people talk about, the reptilian brain, related back to McLean's work. Remember, Jim, had the threefold brain, which was the reptilian brain, which is the basic brain stem and the basic regulation of heartbeat and body temperature and digestion and all the kind of autonomic processes, and that's a reptilian brain. And then he had the old mammalian, which is the limbic system and the subcortical, the midbrain. And then he had the neocortex, which was the new mammalian brain. So David Icke is also seeming to kind of tie in these reptilian beings. He ties them into the kind of psychology of the reptilian brain. And he goes into Sagan quite a bit, and Sagan talking about the reptilian brain and people have following their basic self-interests and animalistic nature. So anyway, it's interesting. It's sure odd what's going on the Earth, and it's certainly a very different perspective.
Whenever anybody talks about reptilian creatures, I always think of that. There's a line, I don't know if I'm quoting it correctly, but it's in Woody Allen's Sleeper, and he's in the future, and they're out in the desert somewhere, and he says to Diane Keaton, don't go out there, there's creatures out there with the body of a lizard and the head of a social worker.
The body of a lizard and the head of a social worker.
I can't ever get past that when people talk about reptilian creatures. Yeah, well, it's interesting that he relates it to that, like in McLean's work, because that is an interesting, his work is interesting. It's an interesting model about, you know, the evolution of things. I was reading, it's funny, just last night I was reading in Yogananda's book, I wanted to reread the chapter on the Law of Miracles, and I just sort of flipping through it, and I had made a lot of notes in the book, and just in one of the footnotes he talks about how modern thinkers and scholars tend to just sort of reflexively dismiss this idea that there have been these ancient civilizations, and he names like Atlantis and Lemuria and different places, and he doesn't really expand on it, but the implication is that they were real, that the history of humanity is much richer and much is much greater than what we generally recognize. I know very little about Blavatsky's work, but I know that she does talk about the different root races, and that she does talk about ancient civilizations. I mean, certainly Gurdjieff makes all sorts of allusions to that too. So, again, he's not really that explicit about things, but he certainly, if you read between the lines, he at times he specifically says that things he says, like of Egypt, that there was a much more ancient Egypt than the one that's recognized, much, much more ancient, that Egypt civilization was much older than people. And he said the original Sphinx, or he said the Sphinx was a copy of a much more ancient statue that the original Egyptians had built. I know that's one example he uses. He talks about pre-sand Egypt, too, that there was a civilization before Egypt was in the desert, which had flourished and which had developed very high technological levels.
And Beelzebub's tales, his first visit, Beelzebub's visit to the planet Earth from the planet Mars, where he's supposed to be set up with an observatory. And his first visit to the planet is during the time of Atlantis. And then in the tales, Gurdjieff has there's this second cataclysmic event, and Atlantis sinks. And he does have the beings having seeded the new world, like came from Atlantis, like they had some forewarning of these catastrophes, and they seeded the new world.
The creature who passes amongst human beings on Earth too, and he has to hide his tail.
Yeah, he has to hide his tail. It's interesting because you see, he's kind of reptilian in Beelzebub's tales.
Yes.
Yeah, he's a reptilian, and they interbreed because they set up a base on the planet Mars, and he in a spaceship he visits the earth at different times in human history. I mean, that's the storyline in Beelzebub's tales. And now, like, for people who think, oh, there's aliens and we're being visited from other planets, like, in a way, that's in Beelzebub's tales. I always took that as analogy before, but now I'm not so sure that I consider that maybe this is meant in, it is really more hiding the truth in what is a story.
Well, you know that at one point he was asked about how much of it was factual and how much of it was, you know, was just a story. And he said everything in Beelzebub is factual.
He said that?
Yeah, he did.
Oh, I didn't know that. I'd never heard that. That's very interesting.
Yeah. And now,
because I, I consider it more.
Yeah, you never know. Like, you know, I mean, he could have... he could have been playing somebody, but at the same time, like, you know, even that, it's sort of the idea of casting doubt is sort of his modus operandi anyways, is that, like, you have to consider all the evidences and try to weigh it and try to dig deeper, you know, because he's buried the dog deeper, you know.
Yeah.
You know, like somebody said, he buried the bone deeper. He said, no, bury the dog. And like, it's like the idea is that the dog is like serious is like the wisdom, eh? The wisdom is buried deeper, or the seeker is buried beneath the, you know, the so many layers that you have to work through to get to, you know, to get to the other realm. And that's the whole challenge in Beelzebub, is there's so much in it that, you know, you don't know what's true and what's, you know, what's made up, and it casts so much doubt on our conventional understanding of everything, as like to destroy without mercy all the rubbish, you know, accumulated in human mentation, you know, is his purpose, and it certainly is disconcerting that way, because that's what it feels like, is like after a while you think, geez, you know, like, you're not really sure of anything.
Yeah, exactly. And but it's interesting. Yeah, like that's what I see in Gurdjieff. When I read Beelzebub's tales before, I think I had a more standard kind of view of human history. And whereas now I much more realize how many unknowns there are, and how we don't know that, for instance, I don't know that there aren't beings on the moon or beings on another planet. I mean, Beelzebub's tales, he sets up an observatory on the planet Mars and has different visits to the planet Earth. And that's exactly what people like David Icke say, and other people, that there are space stations on Mars. And you see that figure on Mars that looks like a Sphinx. Have you seen that, Jim? You're familiar. And the one that looks like a face. So these, and one that is like a kind of a pyramid. So it's all very enigmatic. It's interesting, in Icke's book, Jim, he, in the beginning of his book, he has about four or five major quotations from people. And the last quotation is from Gurdjieff, from In Search of the Miraculous. And the title of the quote, this is at the beginning of his book, it's The Human Story. And that's the title he gives it. And this quote is, it reads, I won't read the whole thing because it's quite long, but is, there is an Eastern tale that speaks about a very rich magician.
That it's about the magician and the sheep.
That's right. Yeah. And this magician was very mean. He did not want to hire shepherds, nor did he want to erect a fence about the pasture where the sheep were grazing. The sheep consequently often wandered into the forest, fell into ravines and so on, and above all they ran away, for they knew that the magician wanted their flesh and their skins, and this they did not like. Well, I'll read through this. At last the magician found a remedy. He hypnotized his sheep and suggested to them, first of all, that they were immortal and that no harm was being done to them when they were skinned, that on the contrary, it would be very good for them and even pleasant. Secondly, he suggested that the magician was a good master who loved his flock so much that he was ready to do anything in the world for them. In the third place, he suggested that if anything at all was going to happen to them, it was not going to happen just then, at any rate, not that day, and therefore they had no need to think about it. Further, the magician suggested to all his sheep that they were not sheep at all. To some of them, he suggested that they were lions, to some that they were eagles, to some that they were men, to others that they were magicians. After this, all his cares and worries about the sheep came to an end. They never ran away, but quietly waited the time when the magician would require their flesh and skins. And it's interesting also because this whole story is also like what Gurdjieff and David Icke say about the nature of the moon.
Yeah.
Like how they say the moon feeds off humankind. It feeds off human souls. And so it's, and David Icke is comparing humankind to these sheep who've been hypnotized.
But the last line of that is great. Isn't there last, does he have the last line?
Well, it ends, but quietly waited the time when the magician would require their flesh and skins.
No,
oh, this tale is a very good illustration of man's position.
Yeah.
David Icke quotes Gurdjieff. Yeah.
I always thought that that story is in Search of the Miraculous. It's just really, it's really scary because it, you know, it's very disturbing. I used that quote actually. That was the opening quote in the original version of my book, But I'll Know My Song Well. About Gurdjieff.
Oh yeah, you used that
at the beginning. At the beginning, that was. Because I think in Search of the Miraculous, that's maybe the most disturbing thing in the entire book, like, because it's just like, you know, Gurdjieff, like, to use a story like that is I mean, you know, a fairy tale or a myth is you know, so much more powerful in a way than an analysis of things, almost, like, you know, like saying, I just, that last line is chilling. This is a very this tale is a very good illustration of the position of man. Is it mankind or human beings? You know, so I mean,
and it's interesting. It's other things Gurdjieff says about the moon also tie in. It's like Gurdjieff explains how the moon feeds off the souls of humankind. And he's saying that human beings, they can live and die according to two principles. And one is the same principle that applies to the life and death of one and two-brained beings, meaning animals. And for those, Gurdjieff says, they live and die, and when they die, their soul feeds the moon. But then, for human beings, the way they're supposed to live and die is that through their life, they're supposed to have attained their higher being bodies, like develop their spiritual bodies, so that then when they die, they don't feed the moon. In the way that the certain soul energies still feed the moon, but in a way the soul escapes and it passes into more favorable afterlife circumstances, like not on the moon, but into the planetary sphere or into the sun or even beyond the sun. It's an amazing concept to imagine that we, in our subtle bodies, might have continued existence within the same solar system. I think that's like that we, you know, we live lives and there are subtle dimensions of the solar system, and that when we die, it's not just all over and we don't just go to heaven, but there's like all different possibilities. You know, we could haunt the earth, we could be in the planetary realm, in the astral worlds, or we could know the spiritual world, or we could be devoured by the moon. Like, you know, our afterlife fate in a way depends on our own evolution and development through our life. And Gurdjieff explains that in Beelzebub's tales, he says that the reason, he tells a story that at one point the organ Kundebuffer was implanted in humankind. See, even this age, Jim, this is like, imagine implanting an organ Kundebuffer in humankind. Like, that's like oh, genetic modification is how you would affect that, eh? But that's part of what, in Gurdjieff's story, these higher individuals, they realize that the beings on planet Earth, that if they woke up and realized that their whole life and death was only to feed the moon, that they would rebel. That's what Beelzebub tells.
Yeah.
And they would kind of protest. They didn't want to just be feed food for the moon. So that was why the organ Kunda buffer was implanted in them, according to Gurdjieff's story. And the organ Kunda buffer was at the base of the spine, and it made people, so that people perceived reality topsy-turvy, like upside down, and no longer perceived reality. And when this organ was implanted in humankind, well, then mankind no longer realized that they were controlled by the moon and that their death would feed the moon. That's all fascinating concept.
Well, here's something from on the other side of it, from Bohm. Bohm says that, this is from Niculescu's book, he says, Bohm describes with no ambiguity faith as nourishment. And this is a quote from Bohm. Christ, according to the eternal word of the deity, eateth not of the substance of heaven as a creature, but of the human faith and earnest prayer, and the souls of men praising God are his food.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. So we can feed higher sources.
We can feed higher sources. And and he has, there's quite a bit in here about the sun too. I think Bohm is very much consistent with Gurdjieff about becoming immortal within the limits of the solar system, and with the idea of going to the sun, rising to the level of the sun. It all seems very consistent to, this is it's funny, in the stereotypical negative image of mysticism. Mysticism involves all these kind of nebulous and unclearly defined and articulated ideas, and it's precisely the opposite. And it's supposed to be, mysticism is supposed to be a source of self-consolation and self-aggrandizement, but in Gurdjieff's vision of things, and in many of these teachings, there's, as you say, what you just described, there's all these different possibilities. We're not all going to heaven to sing with Jesus, after we die. That interpretation is, I think, really, wrong. I think that there are all sorts of possibilities in the afterlife, and what we do here and how we act and how we develop and how we live our lives all have consequences. They have consequences on a whole variety of levels, and whatever does survive of us depends in part on how we live our lives and what we do with our lives. It's precisely the opposite of what I think critics of mysticism say. It's it shows that there's no easy answers to any of these things, it's not something that we're going to just be blindly and mechanically rewarded in the afterlife. It's nothing like that. It's you better take your life seriously. I think that's the message that comes through all of this, and that we have duties. We're not just here for ourselves. We have duties to serve something either higher or lower.
Yeah, I think the story from Gurdjieff that illustrates that most perfectly is that tale described by Fritz Peters, who was his houseboy in France, and Gurdjieff looked out the window and there was a big oak tree. And he asked the boy, how many nuts are there around the oak tree? And Fritz Peters said, there's hundreds, thousands. And Gurdjieff asked, how many of those nuts will become oak trees? And the boy says, maybe just one or two, maybe just a few, maybe none. Gurdjieff says, how many of those nuts become oak trees? Most of them, Gurdjieff says, they become fertilizer and they go back into the ground and they're broken down and their energies feed the go into the ground and they become fertilizer for future man. And he says that position of human beings is much the same, that we don't, like you're saying, we don't just, we're not automatically granted a place in heaven. Instead, we have to strive towards our own self-perfection. We have to, you know, a consciousness cannot evolve unconsciously, mechanically. That this next step in human evolution requires effort on our part, like conscious effort. The next step in human evolution isn't something that happens. It's something that human beings have a responsibility for helping to bring about. And so for Gurdjieff, what we need to acquire our higher being bodies and develop our astral and mental bodies, particularly the mental body, he emphasizes. So for Gurdjieff, this is what it means to acquire our soul, is if we can develop our spiritual body, then that's a vehicle for the continued life on this, of the soul. Otherwise, there's this kind of big cosmic circulation process going on, and we can be drawn to the moon, and we can be imprisoned there in lower conditions, or we can escape and kind of, you know, it's like in Tibetan Buddhism, when you die, you aim to attain the greater body of radiance,
yeah.
Which in Gurdjieff I would say is a level of all worlds. And if you don't attain to that level, which Gurdjieff would call the divine world, well, then the next level you can attain to the lesser body of radiance, which I would take to be the sun and the spiritual world. So there is the idea that, like, what happens after death to people in the mystical tradition, you're drawn into those realms which are most causal in determining your psychology while you're alive. So if you're, in a way, if you're a lunatic controlled by falsity and illusion and delusion, you'll feed the moon. Yeah, whereas if we can escape, to escape is then to feed the sun. So it's interesting, this idea that we're food for higher sources as well, just as we can be food for the moon.
Yeah, and Gurdjieff too. I like his, you know, he talks about our purpose, our sacred being obligations, and one of them is to lighten the sorrows of his endlessness. Like our divine duty is to take some of the burden of whatever, you know, you want to call it, God or the whatever the divine source is. But it's like that, you know, even God needs help, you know, and that's our purpose, is that we can do that by, you know, by intentional suffering and voluntary suffering and intentional sacrifice. You know, it's possible to do that, which is really, I mean, very inspiring. You know, I mean, we talk all the time, and it sounds like it's about, you know, about us, but it, in a sense it is about us, because we have to overcome us, but that's for a purpose of breaking down ourselves so that we can become something higher and we can serve something higher, right? Like, there's always duty,
yeah,
and sacrifice and suffering that are part of this. It's not a selfish thing. It's the opposite of being selfish. Actually, the whole idea in transformation is that the first step is that of purification or purgation, where you have to break down your false personality structure and your existing personality, and you have to surrender the self, and that,
yeah,
always involves sacrifice and suffering, like intense suffering. I mean, most people just can't do it. It's that simple. I mean, you know, no matter how much you aspire to that, it's difficult. That's what the whole mystical and spiritual traditions teaches, is that, you know, it's just very, very difficult to do that. That's why, again, like, you know, let's say somebody talks about being born again. Well, you know, within Gurdjieff's teaching, he talks about being born again, and then people talk in, you know, in various sort of exoteric Christian denominations about being born again. But my understanding of being born again from that perspective is that it's a fairly straightforward process where you make some sort of declaration that you accept Jesus Christ as your Savior, and then you're born again. You're born again in Christ. Well, okay, that, you know, that has meaning and it has some sort of substance to it, I suppose, but it's very, very radically different from the type of being born again that Gurdjieff's talking about. It's like that. I would say that what he's talking about is a much more conscious and much more demanding process.
Yes.
where it's more than a simple declaration. It's a long process of breaking yourself down. Like I say, anybody can say, "Oh, I'm born again." Like it's just easy to say it, but it's completely different to actually do it.
Yeah, to be born again.
That's a kind of, you know, that's just one example why whenever you're talking about anything in religion, when you're talking about anything, you have to talk about the different types of people and the different levels of consciousness that are involved in things. Like, you know, if somebody talks about magic, well, what is magic? There are all sorts of different types of magic. There's magic which is understood on a very low level, which is really kind of just fanciful and self-delusion. But then there's magic which is practiced by people who have developed certain capacities where they can do things which are magical from our perspective, you know. So, I mean, and there's all sorts of different levels and degrees in between. And it's the same with anything, alchemy, astrology, magic, you know, any religious teaching. They're all different in terms of the level and degree of consciousness of the people that are practicing them and that are espousing them. So, you know, people use the same words, but they mean very different things. And I think that's one of the things that's generally not recognized by both people who are critical of these things that don't believe in them, but also by a lot of people who, like, espouse them, like New Age people, sort of, you know, they appropriate certain ideas or certain teachings, but I don't think that often they sort of see the depth in them, and they have a very superficial understanding of them. Like, for instance, Enneagram studies, you know.
I was just going to use as an example, just to keep with, is like what Gurdjieff says about evolution. He says the evolution of consciousness cannot happen unconsciously. Like he says, at this point in human evolution, the possibility for evolution requires our active participation in the process. The next step in evolution is something that it won't just happen. Like, certain evolution happens, but then the evolution of consciousness won't just happen. Like, I think that in New Age concepts, Jim, is like a lot of people kind of putting stock in, oh, a global awakening is going to happen and there's going to be enough people and then everybody will be transformed and we won't have to do anything. It'll happen. Like this new, you know, I'll evolve and I'll wake up and I'll have all these new faculties and all I have to do is wait, kind of.
Yeah.
You know, but for Gurdjieff, no, consciousness cannot evolve mechanically.
Without effort.
We have to make efforts to attain our higher being bodies, otherwise they won't be attained. That maybe over eons and eons of time. Like Gurdjieff sees the souls that pass to the moon. He says they still have the chance of evolution, but it's over a huge time period, like the evolution of the solar system, which is insignificant in terms of the life of a human being. Like, it's over such huge time periods.
Yeah.
So what he's saying is we want to escape this. See, we're trying to escape from the moon. For Gurdjieff, we want to escape the influence of the moon, of the 96 laws of the moon. And then he says that if we can escape the influence of the earth and then be in our essence and be under 12 laws or 24 laws, so then we're kind of free in the spiritual realm. So... Yeah, so I think that's really valuable in Gurdjieff, which you don't see in New Age concepts of evolution, which is something that just happens to people, or you've got to just believe in it, or, you know, for Gurdjieff, that's nonsense. Human evolution, the evolution of consciousness has to be undertaken consciously.
Yeah.
Like the next step in human evolution, it won't happen. If you don't do anything, nothing happens. It's like the missing semitone in the law of the octave. You go do, re, mi, and you don't get any further. You don't get to the next level of human evolution, which is the fa, which is the awakening of the human heart. Unless you make efforts, it won't happen. And I think that's what you were trying to get at a little bit, Jim, when you're saying about people in the Christian tradition, they think they can just accept Christ and they're reborn and that's it, kind of. It's like, I think sometimes that happens to people.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
But I think sometimes there's a falsity to it.
I think in generally, I don't think that leads to anything. I mean, it may make people feel better about themselves, and it may give them, you know, it may have some effects, but it's not going to awaken them. I mean, it may have some positive effects on them. They may become better people. Maybe, maybe not. You know, I mean, there's all sorts of Christians running around who behaving in very unchristian ways, you know. So it's just very mechanical, and it's on a certain level, and that's why that's the kind of thing that people who, you know, deny the reality of religion and who say that, you know, it's all bunk and just dismiss it all, is they seize on I'd say the lower, more exoteric aspects of religion, and they see all the contradictions and all the hypocrisies and all the crimes committed in the name of religion, and they say, well, that just proves that it's all just nonsense and it has no meaning. But that's, you know, that's just one aspect of it. And even on, to sort of contradict myself, but even on that lower level, certainly there are cases where, you know, people accept Christ or have some sort of a spiritual awakening on a conventional level, and it does lead them to become better people, and it does lead them to live their lives in a more righteous fashion. I mean, I'm not denying that, but I just saying that just because you say, oh, I'm born again, doesn't mean you're born again, and it certainly has nothing to do with the kind of what an esotericist is talking about when they say that you're born again. Like, it's a much more complicated, much more difficult process in an esoteric sense. But that was the point I was getting at, is just that the same words can have completely different levels, different meanings depending on the level of consciousness and being that we're talking about, you know, and that's something that, like, that Gurdjieff stresses over and over again. But then, as you say, like, I think your point is right, is that within that fourth way teaching, is that things don't just happen, that consciousness can't evolve by itself in an individual. There has to be an effort, and you have to get over that first missing semitone in the octave of development. You need help. You need some sort of a shock to lift you up to get over that. Otherwise,
yeah, and that for Gurdjieff, though, that shock, though, that's related to C influences. Remember, he talks about A, B, and C influences, and C influences, A influences derive from material life and the sensory realm. But C influences, he says, they come into life from outside of life. It's like these are ideas that come down to us from people who have awakened previously or attained certain things in terms of their development. And these then are their revelations, they're revealed to people. So C influences come into life from out above us, in a sense, outside of life.
One of the things that Gurdjieff says is like, in the fourth way system, is that self-remembering provides the first conscious shock in the octave of development. So, like, if you can remember yourself, you start to develop proper self-consciousness, then there's an awakening of sorts, and there's a transformation from the three classes of a lower human beings to the fourth class, which is somebody who has unity and some of the capacities that we normally ascribe to ourselves in terms of consciousness and being. But then he never identifies what the second conscious shock is. He never actually says what that is. But here's what I think the second conscious shock is. This could be completely wrong, but I think the second conscious shock, and he talks about this in his writing, but he never identifies it as such, is that I think once you've sort of developed self-consciousness, then it's what the organ Kundabuffer, it relates to what the organ Kundabuffer was, which is it's the capacity to remember the inevitability of one's own death and of everyone around us. This is sort of a higher emotional state of presence. So I think it's like related in what you would say, it's like to the awakening of the heart. I think it's like once you have awakened to the level that you have that you develop self-consciousness, then I think it's like the second step that you need to take is that you need to open yourself through the higher emotional center. And by opening yourself through the higher emotional center, then you complete yourself, and then you're awakened. Do you have any idea what I'm talking about?
Well, the second conscious shock, you kind of, yeah, what that is. And I mean, it's related to the opening of the higher emotional center, which I would say is like the awakening of the heart.
Yeah.
And I mean, it's hard to know what the second conscious shock is. I mean, I think it has to do with emotional realizations. And that's what you were kind of saying about it's awaking up to the inevitability of your death and the kind of transience of life.
Because he speaks about that in both Views from the Real World when he's giving his talk, and he speaks about it in Beelzebub's Tales. And I read one time, I've never actually found it, but I read in an article one time that a guy was quoted from the Bhagavad Gita that said, "What's the most amazing thing about human beings?" So something to that effect. And Krishna says the most amazing thing about human beings is that they can forget the inevitability of their own death and of everybody around them. Something to that effect. Eh? So like this idea is like it's in more than one teaching. I think like it requires a level of emotional presence that I think is like, you know, is associated, like as you said, with the higher emotional center. And that's why I don't know that it is the second conscious, but I think that's an element of it. If it's not the second conscious shock, it's at least an element of it. It's like it definitely involves some sort of higher emotional state of presence, and I think that's, you know, if you could really do that, I think you'd be pretty awakened, actually, because nobody can do it.
So anyway, coming back a little bit, so what it's all interesting. This material from David Icke is very interesting.
What's the book that you're reading? I don't know if you...
It's his newest book. It's published this year. It's called Human Race, Get Off Your Knees. Lion Sleeps No More. And I've still got 200 pages left of it. And he's encouraged in a way. Like he sees that there's chance, you know, with the human. Like I think we're in this period, though, of there's kind of a clash of forces around the world. I think people waking up more to the deceptions by our governments and things and the seriousness of what's going on in the world. I think we're in very important time, and he sees that like human race is kind of beginning to wake up, and you know, once people kind of wake up, then it's the lion, I think, represents the heart. In the Wizard of Oz, is the lion, he has strength, but
he has no heart.
No, as a tin man has no heart.
Oh, the tin man has heart, yeah.
Yeah, the lion has strength. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Okay. So anyway, but I think the lion heart, people use that phrase too.
Isn't that now I can't remember, but does the Tin Man not have a brain? Or is
No, I thought the Tin Man had a brain.
Okay,
the lion had no brain.
No, I think it's the other way around. I think the lion lacks courage because he's a cowardly lion. I think he lacks heart.
Oh, yeah. And then he attains his heart.
Yeah, I think so.
Well, that's the idea of David Icke's book, is like, humankind, get off your knees. Like, people, you've been deceived through the centuries. Like, we have to wake up to... you know, what's happening here in the world, and he sees hope in that, and that's an inspiring aspect of his book. But I'm just getting to the end where he has more his prescription for change. But I think, it's fascinating, some of his descriptions about these reptilians related to the moon and how that ties in so much to things Gurdjieff says about the history of about the moon and its influence on our psyche and how our souls feed the moon. And Gurdjieff and Beelzebub's tales, like, partly Beelzebub visited the earth to try to understand the causes of war on the planet Earth, because this was supposed to be so unusual in the greater cosmos that people ordinarily didn't go out and kind of kill each other and murder each other. And this was so rare that Beelzebub was sent to our solar system to try to understand what was the causes of the war, or at least on some of his visits. And then he kind of ties it all into this history of humankind about how the moon broke off from the planet, and the moon needed certain vibrations from the planet, and he has a special name for those. He calls them Ascoken vibrations, and that human beings, by their living and dying, when they die, they feed certain Ascoken vibrations to the moon that allow for the helping to maintain the moon. So the moon feeds off human beings. And that, then people began to realize they were enslaved by the moon, and that's when this organ was implanted in them so that they wouldn't realize how they were being controlled by the moon and eventually sheared like sheep by the moon. So his whole story of the role of the moon, it really comes out interesting in David Icke here. And, and also how he describes this moon matrix, how David Icke kind of describes waveform information as being carried by light, and how the information light from the sun, the moon matrix interferes with that. And then he says of the reptilian types, Jim, that they don't like the sun. I mean, he says of them that they have underground bases on Earth, and they have but they don't like the sun. It's similar in ways, I guess, to the vampire notions, you know. But anyway, he says how their whole matrix interferes with this information from the light of the sun. And that's so interesting in terms of the ray of creation I don't know, I'm trying to pull these things together a little bit. But anyway, fascinating parallels to Gurdjieff. I'm going to reread Beelzebub's tales. I hope to take a holiday for a week to 10 days. I'm going to drive out to PEI and spend some time on the beaches there, I hope, over the next little while, and maybe reread the Beelzebub's tales. I'm more interested now in things Gurdjieff says about the history and the earth changes that happened and things along that line. I'm more aware of that aspect of Beelzebub's tales now, Jim. You know how there's just so much in the book, eh? And in my writing, I focus so far on Beelzebub's tales and the science of the soul. I looked at that aspect of the tales. But there's so much in the history of the tales.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I don't understand what he says about that And he gives some hints about, like, Atlantis and the building of the pyramids and the, you know, these early societies. And I think there's a lot of things hidden in there that, which more and more over time make more and more sense to me. So I want to reread the book again. I haven't read it, I don't think, for 10 years.
Yeah, I actually have been planning. I was just thinking the other day, I've got to read it again, you know. As I keep thinking, oh, I've got to read this, I've got to read that. But what I really need to do is read Beelzebub's Tales again, because it's been a long time since I read it. So, you know, it's funny you mentioned The Wizard of Oz, because I mean, really, that's, you know, you can interpret that as a Sufi tale about, you know, and the Scarecrow and the Tin Man and the Lion can be seen as, you know, the three aspects of our being. It's like a Sufi parable, really. I mean, it can definitely be read that way. But it's funny because I was writing about like what various aspects of, like, when we first encountered the fourth way and we studied it, and how different it was, you know, how the system was, like Uspensky says at one point, like, the fourth way, the more he became involved with the fourth way, the more he felt like he was in contact with something organic, like some sort of a living intelligence rather than just a set of ideas. And I said we sort of came to the same conclusion. And I was like, you know, while most of the people reading this will have no clue as to what I'm talking about or think I'm crazy, I still stand by it, because it's just, you know, it was that dramatic, like, to be involved with these ideas. And I said, the here's what I wrote. The simple fact is that for Christopher and I, our conceptualization and understanding of the nature of reality, quote unquote, had undergone such a radical transformation that we were quite certain that any attempt to reduce the meaning of what we were experiencing to conventional thought and establish truths would constitute an absurdity. We knew that we were not in Kansas anymore. We had entered the mystical realm. And you know, really, I mean, that's it, eh? It's like once you get into this to a certain extent, I mean, everything changes, and you realize that sometimes you have to entertain seemingly crazy ideas because my understanding of reality is so far divorced from what most people's understanding of reality is, that it's, you know, it's hard to imagine in a way.
Yeah. Yeah, life is a profound mystery play like this.
Yeah.
And I think we early on, we both woke up during that period enough that we realized what a mystery it was. And I think profoundly important to me was all realizing what overwhelming evidences there were, and what I would consider scientific evidences, for the fact that we are not simply beings that live and die with a material body, and that we're just limited to the body. Like, if you realize, oh, we can have out-of-body experiences, and that there can be other beings who don't have bodies or in other dimensions, or people can travel down the tunnel into a realm of light, and people have synchronous things happen that have meaning in their lives, and there's number coincidences, and there's evidences for ghosts and possessions and all these things. You realize what a mysterious universe it is, and if you embrace that these, well, how can we understand these things instead of always just demanding more and more proof that these phenomena exist? To just accept that, yeah, we live in a multidimensional universe, so there has to be a science to it. There has to be a way of trying to understand how it all could work. And, like, where are these afterlife worlds? Well, I would say now that they're related to the sun and the moon and the planets and the solar system and the galaxies, that you know, the afterlife worlds are within the same spaces as we're already within. And these afterlife worlds, they are related to these cosmic bodies. Like, I believe there are afterlife worlds possible within the moon or within the earth or within the atmospheres or within the sun or within the galaxy. So, you know, it's a multidimensional universe, and we exist somehow in this sea of information and these planes of different being existence, you know, and what we really are is a mystery. I think what's obvious is we are not simply the material body mind. There's something far, far deeper, and it is a mystery. And these concepts of the heart doctrine is an amazing idea, that we have a zero-point center or some kind of individual I related to the heart, and that we have an original center, and somehow that we have different bodies and we can exist within different planes of being and afterlife states and so on. I mean, it's a much richer, beautiful cosmos than to think that, oh, we're just biological organisms. We lived and died because of random processes and fortunate genetics and that's all there is to it. There's something far, far deeper in life. And life is just so profound. It's so inexplicable, all these mysteries.
I see that whole materialist interpretation and all the sort of metaphysical pronouncements from that perspective is just being complete hokum. I realize, like, the more I study that, the more I realize is that there's science and there's the facts of science and there's all sorts of research, but there are so many pronouncements that are extrapolated from the data which aren't at all supported by the data. Like, it's just bad science in the sense it's like Werner Heisenberg said one time to Friedrich Capra, he had been reading Jacques Monod's book on chance and necessity, and Monod, you know, was a French biologist who won the Nobel Prize, and he wrote that, you know, that the covenant had been broken and that man was in this, you know, was in this purposeless, meaningless universe, and, you know, it was like, is on his own, blah, blah, blah. It was like, you know, the usual really nihilistic kind of pronouncements. And Heisenberg said, you know, good science, bad metaphysics, you know, and exactly, you know, it's like, it's all of these, mm-hmm. all of these statements that, Richard Dawkins says that Darwin's theory of evolution allowed him to be a fulfilled atheist. You know, like, you know, I still don't understand how he draws that conclusion. You know, I mean, it's based on such a limited understanding of religion. That's the first part, because what he's saying is that because Darwin overthrew certain fundamentalist interpretations of the Bible, that sort of somehow that this obliterated God, and you know, like, it's a completely idiotic, you know, conclusion. It's just not realistic. So I see that. And then the other side of it, as you say, is like, it's, well, there's two parts, and you talked about this before, but the on another program, and again, I was writing about this, I said that we had come to understand the importance of emptying ourselves of so much of what Gurdjieff would characterize as the rubbish accumulated in our mentation in order to open and free ourselves so that we might enter into and admit into ourselves a new order of meaning. And that's it. Like, you've got to, it's like what you said, like, you know, to try to understand these things, but to try to understand these things in a way, you have to sort of get over your education. You have to get over all the wrong ideas that have been implanted and imprinted and conditioned into you about how things are and what's real and what's not. You realize that so much of what passes as knowledge and explanations of things is just like, it's just people talking, you know, it has no meaning. And mm-hmm. it precludes a serious examination of things that need to be examined, you know, and there's, as you say, there's all this evidence to support all of these ideas about how we're, that point to the idea that we're multidimensional beings that exist in a multidimensional universe, and so the more intelligent course of action is to try to, there has to be a way that this works, so how, let's try to figure out how it works, you know, and that's what reading esoteric and mystical literature brings you. It's there. There's an explanation of it. It's a very cogent explanation of it.
Yeah, and it's very complex and subtle and different languages, and we've tried to piece it together from studying a wide variety of esoteric teachings. And it's so interesting then how you find the themes that are repeated over and over again, like about consciousness and the heart and, you know, the laws of 3 and 7 and multidimensional existence and
holographic principles and things.
Yeah.
That I guess that's the thing for me is that any doubt that I've ever had about this has been sort of erased in the last, I would say, 10 to 15 years. Now, I mean, I never, for the longest time, I was pretty sure, but now I am sure. It just, it's like good science, you know. It's been repeated in various laboratories over the earth throughout the ages, you know, like, I mean, and the laboratories are essentially people's consciousness, you know, like, I mean, there just couldn't be the recurrence of these ideas without them, there being something to them, you know.
It's, yeah.
And I guess the other thing is that the elegance and the precision of the explanations is something, and like I mentioned on another program, before about reading Gurdjieff the first time. When I first started reading Gurdjieff, I just realized that this was somebody who actually knew what they were talking about, you know. There was Jacob Needleman in his latest book on God talks about that and says that, you know, there was just this authority in Gurdjieff mm-hmm. when he read him that he just had never encountered before. And that's the way I feel about it, too. And,
yeah.
and I think that's what distinguishes true esoteric writing from everything else, is that there's no imagination and there's no, in the bad sense of the term.
Yeah, there's a different kind of authority.
There's
yeah.
just the quality of the thought, which is, you know, there's just absolutely zero bullshit in it. And you can feel when you read it that this is something somebody knows and understands. It's not something they're saying off the top of their head so that they've thought up as some sort of an elaborate explanation. It has a veracity that's almost palpable, and you can recognize it. After a while, I think you just become more and more sensitized to it, and you can recognize it.
Okay, so I notice we just have a minute left, so we'll need to close down. And this has been Jim Moffat and Christopher Holmes, and we've been discussing issues of science and mysticism, and today the control over them of the moon and a possibility of reptilians and other beings, how we need to wake up and attain our souls and attain our higher being bodies. And if you're facing death, you want to pass into the greater body of radiance. And and looking at trying to understand what the dimensions of a multidimensional universe might be and how a human being might really, as a microcosm of the macrocosm, be able to live in various ways within our solar system, even beyond the end of life with physical death, that there's something more complicated going on here. Okay, thank you, Jim. We'll be back in 2 weeks.
Yep, thanks, Chris.
I've almost submitting the God Science and the Secret Doctrine to get a proof copy. I hope to do that on Monday.
Oh, really? Oh, okay.
Yeah, so I'm gonna take that and do a final edit on it and hopefully have it finished within a month or so.
Oh,
yeah, I'm gonna do one more edit on it then, you know. Yeah.
Good.
I'm really pleased with that.
Okay.
Good. Take care. Okay.
Yeah, bye.
Visit www.zeropoint.ca. Okay, take care. Thanks all. Goodbye.